You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
PRI's Studio 360 is made possible in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Math is the one place where truth and beauty are the same thing.
I had all these obsessions with counting.
10 times 10.
Counting
times
10 four times 10, and 10, making 10, sure 10, the things 10. Were balanced.
This is Studio 360 from WNYC in New York and Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson. On today's show, a composer obsesses over numbers.
It's related to where rhythm comes from or something, of wanting physically to manifest some sort of numerical structure.
And an economist tries to quantify artistic genius.
I basically took auction data from the last 30 years and simply said, at what point in this person's life did they do the paintings that would then become the most expensive paintings?
My guest today is the actor and mathematician Danica McKellar. That's all ahead in Studio 360, where art and real life collide. Recently, I found myself thinking about the big Tinky Winky brouhaha of 1999.
Tinky Winky,
Tinky Winky.
You must remember the Tinky Winky controversy. That was when Jerry Falwell, the conservative Christian watchdog, announced that Tinky Winky is gay.
Hello.
I was thinking about that insane cultural moment because of a fresh controversy that involves another set of allegedly gay PBS puppets. There's a new satirical 8-minute movie called Ernest and Bertram, which premiered at the Sundance Film Festival earlier this year. The premise of the film is that the Sesame Street puppets, Bert and Ernie, are gay lovers whom a supermarket tabloid has outed. Even though Sesame Street has featured parodies of pop culture for 34 years, the producers of Sesame Street are unamused.
That's a friend, Bert. A pal. Not minding. That's what friends are for.
In a tone of high earnestness, a company spokesman said, Ernie and Bert are friends who live together. There's nothing sexual in their relationship.
You don't mind it. That's what friends are for.
Sesame Street lawyers have sent a cease and desist letter to the creator of the movie. But the Bert and Ernie spoofs seem to be spreading fast. At the Manhattan Theater Club in New York last month, a new musical comedy called Avenue Q was staged. Avenue Q is performed by puppets. The show's MC announces that it's, quote, Sesame Street for grown-ups. And a Bert and Ernie-esque couple in the show named Rod and Nikki are quite possibly gay. When I searched the internet to see if the Sesame Street lawyers have sent a letter to the producers of Avenue Q, I came across an account of the Bertram and Ernie tussle. It was on a British gay news website called RainbowNetwork.com. There I read, quote, rumors concerning the puppet's supposed sexuality have dogged the Children's Television Workshop for years, according to the Urban Legends Reference Pages website. So I went to the Urban Legends Reference Pages, where I read the following definitive urban legend explanation, and I quote, though it's impossible to pin down where the Bert and Ernie are gay rumor began, one potential source is The Real Thing, a 1980 book by Kurt Anderson. In this book, Anderson makes the whimsical claim that among homosexuals, Bert and Ernie are the real thing. Could this cheeky comment have been the genesis of the rumor that now so plagues Sesame Street? What can I say? It was a joke. I'm not sure if this qualifies as life imitating art or art imitating life imitating art, but I have learned something. All those urban legends floating around do not just spontaneously pop out of the ether. They're all concocted by individual mischief makers, most of whom get to remain anonymous. This is Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. The amazing German composer Kurt Weill was born in 1900. Tributes are still happening 2 years after the centenary of his birth. They include a large exhibition and performance series going on now at the New York Public Library. Weill's music has lent itself to all kinds of interpretations, from cabaret to reggae to big arty theater. But it will always bear the imprint of one spectacular performer, as Sarah Fishko explains.
Can you tell me how these things happen?
That voice.
Have I trusted in love too much?
That unmistakable voice.
When did the magic vanish? Have I somehow lost my touch?
It's a voice famously described as one octave below laryngitis.
Could I love you? Could he love me?
It's a long, long while.
The voice belongs to Lotta Lynn. She married Kurt Weill first in 1926, then again in the 30s, and sang his songs throughout her career. And as time passes, one still cannot forget that voice.
Und das Schiff mit acht Segeln.
Lotta Lynn was the embodiment of the Weill sound. And the Weill-Lenya partnership was one of those rare cases in which a composer really did have an embodiment such as that, which makes taking on the Weill repertoire a bit daunting, even for the likes of Teresa Stratus.
In 1979, the first day of rehearsals of the Metropolitan Opera of Mahagoni, John Dexter, the director, said to me, Teresa, if you look out into the dark audience, and look right down the center, you'll see a shock of red hair, and that's Kurt Weill's widow, Lotta Lenya. And I thought I'd go through the stage of the opera house. After I was introduced to her, I'd run out there and I'd say, oh, Madam Lenya, could you please tell me, is there anything I can do that you would prefer? Please tell me. And she'd sort of pat my hand and she said, no, nothing, dear, just do what you're doing. But all the way through the rehearsals, I thought, oh my goodness, I'm so hopeless. She won't tell me a thing. She's not wasting her time. And then after that, she gave me all the music that was unpublished. And that became the recording of the unknown Kurt Weill. So I guess she liked me.
Stratus' enormously successful unknown Kurt Weill recording was released in the early 80s. And the performances are, of course, very much in her own style.
There's no way to imitate Lenya. To be a copy of anything never has interested me. I believe that's outside of whatever admiration she might have had for my way of singing her husband's music. She didn't have the fear that I was going to try to imitate anyone else.
So strong and indelible as the Lenya Weill recordings are, there have been strong artists like Stratus. There have been the famous recordings of Mack the Knife by Louis Armstrong and Bobby Darin. And there's been a steady stream of others searching for new ways to bring Weill's songs up to date.
I'm not a purist. I happen to love all interpretations of Kurt Weill's music. For instance, I really love the Doors version of Alabama Song.
Well, show me the way to the next whiskey bar.
The Doors recording of Weill and Brecht's famous song from Mahagoni appeared in the late 60s,
we must find the
opening the way for recordings by Marianne Faithfull.
We'll find the next whiskey bar. I tell you we must die.
I tell you we must die.
David Johansen.
I tell you we must die. I tell you we must die.
Dave Van Ronk.
We now must say goodbye.
We love
Ralph Chouquette and Richard Butler.
And must have whiskey all, you know why.
Wonderful, just wonderful.
Yeah.
They're all great interpretations. So, you know, and then there's, of course, always coming back home to Lenya. So.
Lotta Lenya died in 1981 at age 83. Teresa Stratus spent many days with her just at the end of her life.
She was very generous. Whatever she said about me, that I'm the only one, and that she passes the crown to me and carry on the torch and all those things. But the fact of the matter is that there's only one Lenya, and that's the royalty is Lenya, as Callas was, as Piaf was. It's absolutely direct. They don't try to endear themselves in any way. I think that directness and that honesty is a very important lesson for all young singers.
Recordings of Vile songs by Teresa Stratus, The Doors, Louis Armstrong, Bobby Darin, Elvis Costello, Lou Reed, and others are still available. These precious days. When listening to Vile, rejoice in the variations. And, by all means, go back to the original. For Studio 360, I'm Sarah Fischko.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and it's time now for this week's cover story. We're looking at mathematics.
Perhaps it is good to have a beautiful mind, but an even greater gift is to discover a beautiful heart.
At the Oscars this year, A Beautiful Mind showed that there's virtually a math fad going on in pop culture, which is weird because individually you might be inclined to say that math is boring. But culturally, we seem to love what math seems to do. Think of the geometric fantasies of M.C. Escher's pictures or the fantastical curves in Frank Gehry's buildings, which would be impossible without computers grinding through algorithms and millions of calculations. Math is pretty much every artist's tool for counting out a beat or focusing a lens. It's often a metaphor for purity, for complexity, or for enigma. My guest today is Danica McKellar. She's best known for her role as Winnie Cooper on The Wonder Years, but that was a decade ago. And in the last decade or so, Danica has directed an independent film and continued to act. And she graduated from UCLA with a degree in mathematics, which brings her here today. She even has a theorem named after her. Danica McKellar, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you very much.
Now, why did you take what strikes me anyway as a sort of detour into mathematics?
You know, I didn't plan on it. When I was in high school, I always did like math. I always seemed to gravitate towards it. But my career was acting. And when I went to UCLA, in fact, the reason I went there was because I wanted to be a film major. But when I got there, you don't actually begin your film school studies until your junior year. So the first couple of years, you're just taking normal classes. And I kind of missed math. And so I started taking some math classes. And the first math class that I took was a calculus course. And I somehow did really well in all these classes. And I just loved it. So I kept taking the classes. And I was encouraged to be a math major. And I actually got the opportunity to co-author a math research paper with another student and my professor, Lincoln Shays at UCLA. And we wrote a paper in the area of statistical mechanics and proved the new theorem. And, you know, the thing about research is that you don't know when you're trying to prove a theorem if it's going to be true or not. So you might be wasting your whole year on something that is never going to be able to be published because it won't be true. And we got lucky. And after lots and lots of hard work, I mean, 12-hour days, 5 days a week for months and months at a time, we ended up solving it.
Now, you went from being this being an actress, an actor, and a child star to this incredibly, seemingly different pursuit of math in college. Was that a did it require your brain to just sort of reset itself? And how you spent your time must have been so radically different.
Oh yes. Well, I was always very much a student, though, on the set. You know, when you're acting as a child, you have 3 hours of allotted time for school time on the set. And I used to spend much more time than that. And I would always be in the schoolroom trailer studying while all the other kids were, like, goofing off. I would sit there. I was very serious.
Just like your character.
Yeah. Pretty much. Actually, I was worse.
Really?
I've always been a nerd. And when I say that with with, you know, affection and lightheartedness. It's not, I don't really think of a nerd as a bad thing. I think of a nerd as somebody who loves to study and loves to learn stuff. And I think there's nothing wrong with that at all.
You say you did this theorem, you solved this theorem with collaborators, but isn't mathematics, generally speaking, a much more lonely pursuit than, say, making television or films?
The thing that's so isolating about math is that people that you care about in your everyday life don't really have the patience or the knowledge to listen mm-hmm. to anything that you're thinking about. And when you're doing math, at least when I was doing math, and this is pretty typical, you become completely immersed in it, completely. When you're doing research, you don't think about anything else. You have to be that inside of it in order to discover something new about it. So, and that's why the stereotype of the absent-minded professor bumping into things, that was me for a while. It really was. My mom used to comment on it, that I would just totally space out and not even be in the room. And I remember going to parties and hoping to find a physicist or something, you know, like somebody who might have something really cool and scientific to talk about or who might listen to what I'm thinking about, because your interests become so different from most people. And it turned out that I wasn't able to share what I was feeling passionate about with anybody who I cared about. And that was difficult for me.
In plays like Proof, which is about mathematicians, and in movies like A Beautiful Mind, people talk about the elegance and the beauty of mathematics. And in those works, they seldom really give an idea of what that beauty is. Is there, do you find, as somebody who is a filmmaker as well as a mathematician, there's really what we know as beauty in math?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, in fact, the reason why I like math so much versus chemistry or physics and biology, and I do like those, but those are sciences that human beings have used to try to describe the world around them, try to approximate it best they can. And all you ever get with those are approximations. With math, mathematics is a science that was born in the imaginations of humans. And we've built the whole thing from the ground up. Math is built on a set of basic axioms that are from our imaginations. I mean, one of the axioms describes what a point is. What if we had an infinitely small speck that doesn't actually exist, but we could use that as a way of locating things? And then if you take an infinite amount of those in a certain way, you get a line, which is actually infinitely thin. You know, what is that? I mean, it's completely in the imagination. It doesn't actually exist. But from all of those kinds of axioms, we've built the entire structure of mathematics. So it remains a perfect, crystalline, beautiful art form, as opposed to the other sciences that we use math to speak in. We speak the other languages in the language of mathematics, but those are not pure sciences. The only pure science is mathematics, and that's what makes it an art.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and Danica McKellar is my guest today. In a minute, we'll hear from a composer who works her right brain against her left. Stay with us in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. My guest is the actor and math expert, Danica McKellar. Mathematics and music are inseparable. After all, harmony is measured in the gaps between notes that we call thirds, fourths, fifths, and so on. But the math in music isn't always simple at all. In the 1920s, Arnold Schoenberg and other composers invented a way to write music purely by the numbers. They assign different values to the spaces between notes or to specific pitches and then plug those numbers into musical formulas. A lot of the time, the result felt cold and strange, but this style drove a lot of 20th century classical music. Composer Yves Baglarian looked at this tradition and decided those mathematical formulas could express deeper emotional truths. Jocelyn Gonzalez has the story.
I don't know if you were like this as a kid, but I had all these obsessions with counting and counting to four and making sure the things were balanced and stuff. And I think of it as a sort of mild form of autism, actually, you know? And I think a lot of musicians have that.
That obsession with counting served Eve Baglarian very well in a house filled with music. The offspring of two musicians, she learned to play her scales at the same time she learned to read. But her predestined path to music took a sharp detour in her teens.
I happened to go to this girls' high school in Los Angeles, which was an extremely trippy experience that was really good for me because it taught me to mistrust authority at a very early age. But one of the things that was deeply odd about this school was that the sort of intellectual quality of the humanities was really low by comparison to what was going on in the sciences. I was interested in, like, biochemistry of the brain, like neurobiology and stuff like that. You know, it just seemed really cool to me. And I got to Princeton, and they actually put me in a dorm with a lot of other sort of pre-med types and science types. And by October, I was, like, having a nervous breakdown. Because I really had not realized the degree to which thinking like an artist pervaded my life. And so I pretty quickly changed the courses I was taking more towards the humanities and then towards music.
Despite switching back to the artistic track, Eve didn't leave her Jones for figures and formulas behind. The intellectual atmosphere at Princeton helped her combine her contrary interests. Alongside the Baroque and the Romantic, she studied minimalism and Schoenberg's invention of 12-tone serialism.
Basically, what you do is you come up with a row of all 12 pitches in the equal-tempered scale, and you put them in a particular order that you think is a cool order.
You can actually count.
So you can convert this row of pitches into a set of intervals, and you can make them go forwards or backwards or... Then you can apply that to a rhythm of, you know, eighth notes and 16th notes or whatever, and you're creating rhythmic structures from an underlying pitch structure. If you do this at a high level, you end up in a field of mathematics called combinatorial mathematics, which is some branch of number theory. If I'm, you know, I'm not a mathematician, but this is my understanding. Musicians who were interested in these things ended up in this little tiny corner of mathematics where they could prove cool theorems in mathematics, right? Which is, like, fun. It's entertaining, right? Composing that way is really hard work because the systems aren't helping you. You're, in fact, fighting with the systems all the time. And when you're starting out as a composer, having something to bang up against that's, like, really monolithic and really reliable is extremely helpful. So what interested me was to apply the same techniques that the beep-clonk atonalists were using to make music that I felt was more beautiful.
At some point, this small universe of math and music grew a bit stifling, and Eve Baglarian started to sneak away.
For me, writing The Garden of Cyrus and grappling with these systems, which were beginning to get on my nerves because they were sort of in the way of ideas and emotions and things that I wanted to express in music, it was really useful to do it as well as I could and then say, okay, I've mastered this as well as is interesting to me or productive to me as an artist. And now I'm going to have to fly without a net.
After Cyrus, Eve scaled musical structures of the non-numerical kind. She tackled narrative in collaborations with dancers and choreographers. She's composed for avant-garde theater and the Beijing National Opera. She's even reset a 12th century morality play as an electronic jam. In all these explorations, she's still wrestling with a system. Not numbers, but language.
To invent height would be quite enough. A text gives me a structure to bang up against that is nonetheless extremely flexible. It's much more like a conversation than a rant. And I use text a lot in my music, even in the pieces that are purely instrumental pieces. There's often a text that was the animating idea for the piece.
Those words and the pieces that grew out of them are being collected by Eve into a lifelong multimedia project called The Book of Days. She's creating and collaborating on 365 pieces for live performance, film, and internet delivery, one work for each day of the year. In using the calendar grid, her past, present, and future work resonate with personal meaning.
June 8th is not just June 8th. It's a whole bunch of stuff. And the layers of those things, both good and bad, you know, falling in love, someone dying, you know, whatever it is, layer on top of each other so that for each of us, we all have a book of days that we're carrying around. Yes, it's an arbitrary structure, but it's an arbitrary structure that gets invested with meaning, with very deep meaning, over time.
Do not be concerned from morning until evening, and from evening until morning. Do not be concerned about what you will wear.
To me, pure mathematics is, after all, a metaphorical structure for understanding the world. And its relation to the world is sort of, for a pure mathematician, somewhat secondary. It's more creating the structure that is satisfying, as far as I understand it. And that purity of using your mind to build these structures that are internally satisfying and coherent.
There's one element that comes up equal on both sides of Eve's approach to composition, and I think that it is a quest for purity. On the one side, she studied these serialist traditions and tried to make them beautiful. But on the other side, she strives for perfect emotional expression. Eve looks at these opposite ends as congruent.
It's going someplace that only you, for whatever combination of reasons, can access directly, and then bringing that back and making it available to others. So in a way, I see the artist as a middleman or middle woman, middle person between the unknown and the humane, you know? And maybe a mathematician is very much like that.
For Studio 360, I'm Jocelyn Gonzalez.
Eve Baglarian's next project is a piece for the Bang on a Can All-Stars. You can find out more on our website, studio360.org. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, talking about math today with the actress, filmmaker, and mathematician, Danica McKellar. Danica, Eve Baglarian said something about thinking like an artist versus thinking like a scientist, mm-hmm. and her whole work seems so much about trying to merge those things in that are often so caricatured as being different ways of thinking. Having been both, being both, do you find a disjuncture in your own experience between the mathematician side and the creative side?
Well, I think that's the biggest challenge in being an artist, or as a mathematician, because you have to use both sides of your brain, and they don't really work at the same time, in my experience so far. It's more like it's like a relay race. One of them drops off, the other one has to pick up, because you can't, in order to really create things, you can't be too analytical about it. On the same side, if you just let your brain kind of go to motion and go, well, let me just see if something's going to come to me now, you know, sometimes that doesn't always work. For me, the first inspiration to write a story or to conceive of a shot or whatever it is, it usually has nothing to do with analyzing things. But then, you know, once it's been born, then it kind of needs to be guided with your analytical mind. And mm-hmm. so that, I mean, my experience is definitely using both together, but not really at the same time. They kind of interact with each other. But I have to keep an eye on it, because if I'm writing something and suddenly there are problems with it and it's just not feeling right anymore, Then my analytical side may come in and say, okay, well, how do I solve this problem? And I can kind of break it down into different elements. Okay, what do I really want to say here? What really needs to happen by this page? And what can't I reveal yet? And you know, then you go ahead and try to solve the problem that way. But usually the best ideas come from inspiration from a different place while you're doing that all that analytical work, for me. I know that Einstein talked about that, and he said that his best ideas came when he wasn't, you know, came from his complete imagination, has no idea where it came from. He would spend all his time working on analytical solutions, but the actual things that usually worked slip in when you're not looking for them.
I think that's absolutely right.
And that's the other side of the brain. I don't know how that happens.
People talk about various kinds of music, like Mozart or even somebody like Herbie Hancock, as hearing all these complicated mathematical patterns in those. Are there certain kinds of music that appeal to you at the math head part of you?
Well, I don't know. I mean, they say that listening to classical music makes you smarter, but because of all the structure involved. I really enjoy a lot of different kinds of music. I do love classical music, but I don't think it's because I'm sitting there feeling structure in it. I don't know. That's possible, but I try not to, you know, I'm not a composer myself, so I don't have any real reason for trying to break down how you get to a certain sound in music. And as much as I can, because I've got such an analytical mind, I try not to tear things apart too much that I don't need to.
Danica McKellar is my guest, and you're listening to Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. David Gallinson is an economist who studies labor markets, but he's always been fascinated with the ways that artists, painters in particular, work, ever since he took a college art class nicknamed Spots and Dots. These days, Gallinson is aiming his quantitative skills at one question. Why is it that some artists produce their best work when they're relatively young and others when they're old? Fred Mogul reports.
Some scientists believe you can take the measure of famous minds by actually measuring the size of their brains. University of Chicago economist David Gallinson also thinks you can measure how great minds operate, but in a little different way. He says he can tell you how the great modernist painters thought and worked by measuring their textbook citations and their auction sales.
I basically took auction data from the last 30 years and simply said, at what point in this person's life did they do the paintings that would then become the most expensive paintings when they were sold at auction? And I discovered that of the major modern artists, some of them did their most important work after decades of experience, and others did what would become their most valuable work very early in their careers.
Gallinson's new book is called Painting Outside the Lines. He charts dozens of 19th and 20th century painters and separates the young bucks from the veteran workhorses. He also surveys art history books and says he's not surprised to learn that scholars, like art buyers, consistently seem to value some parts of major artists' careers over others. At the same time, Gallinson also notices another pattern surrounding one of his favorite paintings, George Seurat's pastel pixelated masterpiece, Sunday Afternoon on Le Grand Jatte.
Why is it that Seurat has a painting that appears in virtually every book, whereas in contrast, Cézanne has more paintings illustrated in the textbooks than any other artist who worked in 19th century France, but that there's no one painting that appears frequently in those books? So why is it that a relatively minor artist created a painting that was much more famous than any work by the much greater artist?
Gallinson believes his columns of numbers, when backed up with biographical research, systematically quantify artistic genius. His grand unified theory is that there are two types of artists. Late bloomers like Cézanne are, quote, experimental innovators. They're traditionally trained. They don't have single pinnacle artworks. They use trial and error and take decades to solve visual problems, like light or perspective. The other type, early bloomers like Picasso or Seurat, are, quote, conceptual innovators. They make sudden, cataclysmic breakthroughs. They challenge the very nature of art and sometimes generate greatest hits paintings that end up in every anthology. Gallinson's perhaps biggest find, however, is how art historians have utterly refused to consider either his methods or his conclusions. Professor Jeff Hardwick studies visual culture in museums at Temple University.
His emphasis that the conceptual innovators are about ideas and the experimenters are more about the visual It just seems too overarching. That, yes, you can find nice quotes from both of them saying that, but I imagine you could also find Andy Warhol saying, you know, he's interested in color as much as he is interested in the idea of the Campbell soup can. And so where does that line get drawn then between these two camps?
Hardwick at least read the book, which is more than Gallinson says most other professors and journal editors have done. Hardwick doesn't even mind the graphs, tables, and numbers. In fact, he'd like more of them. He thinks Gallinson would do better with the art history establishment if Gallinson used numbers to connect artists to the world around them, rather than just categorizing them by work style. For example, Hardwick says that when Gallinson's writing about Jackson Pollock, his statistics only tell part of the story of Pollock's meteoric rise in the 1940s and 50s.
There's all sorts of arguments about New York coming to prominence in the world of art, not so much because they have an incredible breakthrough, but more that they are able to have the weight of American power coming out of World War II behind them. It becomes easy for Life magazine to do a profile of Jackson Pollock because it's abstract, because it's a blank signifier in which people can project any meaning, not because it's a wonderfully new innovation, but because it sort of fits the moment in 1950s America.
Hardwick represents the new generation of social historians, and the irony is that Gallinson, for all his numbers, might just have more in common with the old guard traditionalists, the same ones who think he's trying to reduce artistry to actuarial tables. After all, Gallinson's systematic comparative study and multiple regression analysis are just ways his numerical mind wraps itself around the classic question his college art professors asked him all those years ago. What is the artist trying to say?
My work has changed my understanding of the way I answer that question, because now, instead of simply coming to the painting with my knowledge of, you know, who the painter is, I look and see when the painting was done. Because what Picasso was trying to tell us at different stages of his career was very different, whereas what Cézanne was trying to tell us throughout a very long period was the same, but he couldn't tell it to us as well earlier as late.
Gallinson says he hopes his book will help readers look at how they themselves think, learn, and create, just as it's helped him assess his own work patterns. He generally thinks of himself as a slow and steady, trial-and-error experimenter, but he also thinks his latest work represents a breakthrough, and one that's already steeply increased the value curve of his career. For Studio 360, I'm Fred Mogul.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 today with the actor and filmmaker Danica McKellar, and we're talking about various kinds of art and mathematics. Danica, Professor Gallinson also says, we didn't hear in that piece, but he also says that he can take certain measurements from an artist's life, like the lifelong auction prices for the work, and actually predict from that whether or not the artist made sketches before his paintings. Hollywood is obviously full of all kinds of even cruder formulas to measure talent and marketability, like the famous Q ratings of performers. Yep. Do you find any merit in those things, or the incredible research that's done before any film opens and the numbers that are assigned to audience reactions and things like that?
Well, films seem to be failing left and right, so practically speaking, it doesn't seem to be working very well. But in theory, I mean, sure. In that case, they're not measuring art. They're measuring what audiences are responding to in terms of, you know, stars and star power. And yeah, I guess that makes sense. If I were in charge of making sure that the studio's money was spent well, I would want to make sure that they was going to have a good draw and have a good opening weekend. That's only one side of filmmaking. Of course, you have to make sure you've got a quality film to bring in the people for the rest of the weekends after that. But yeah, I mean, you have to, I would imagine that that's very important. It's a very important tool to quantitatively measure the probable success of an opening weekend, because so much money is put into those films, and it costs so much money to advertise the films and to open.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 with the actor and filmmaker Danica McKellar. Coming up, the current math fad in the movies.
You're as glamorous as fighter pilots. Girls you couldn't even hope to meet go weak at the knees at the thought of the size of your brain.
Stay with us in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International.
Thank you.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and my guest is Danica McKellar. We're talking about mathematics. When people in Hollywood talk about movie math, they generally mean the elaborate, not to say fraudulent, accounting. It's what can turn a $200 million box office take into a big loss. But there's a lot of math in movies as well, and not just A Beautiful Mind, as Matt Holzman reports.
Sum of the square roots of any two sides of an isosceles triangle is equal to the square root of the remaining side.
Even if he does mangle the Pythagorean theorem, the Scarecrow is still the most psychologically and emotionally balanced mathematician ever portrayed in the movies. Typically, they're mad, as in A Beautiful Mind, but sometimes they're just plain angry.
What do you want?
I'm Gerald Lambeau. I've spoken to the judge, and he's agreed to release you under my supervision. But under two conditions.
What are those?
First condition is that you meet with me every week. And the second condition is that... that you see a therapist.
All right, I'll do the math, but I'm not going to meet with any fucking therapist.
Somewhere in between the hot-headed Will Hunting and the cold Dr. Lambeau is the meek mathematician, such as Dustin Hoffman as the savant in Rain Man. Then there's Dustin Hoffman doing it all as a mathematician who transforms from coward to killer in Straw Dogs. Arnold Reinhold has created a website dedicated to math in the movies.
Well, I think mathematicians sort of fall in the broader rubric of scientists who are generally treated not all that well in the movies. They're usually advancing the plot by doing something evil or bad or foolish or something like that. But I think that's true of most professions. I'm not sure policemen get treated fairly or if Shakespeare treated kings fairly.
A computer consultant and self-admitted PhD dropout, Reinhold is really more concerned with the math itself.
One of the things I put on my site is I sort of only want good math recommendations because there's so much bad math.
Their calibrations appear to indicate that they are set in decimal series, each division recording exactly 10 times as many amperes as the one preceding it. 10 times 10 times 10 times 10 times 10 times 10. On and on and on, row after row, gauge after gauge. The number 10 raised almost literally to the power of infinity.
There's no such thing as almost infinity, but the math hocus-pocus in a 50s sci-fi flick like Forbidden Planet was only there to add a little science to the fiction. It works like a magician's misdirection. As long as we're mesmerized by the math, we don't look too closely at the set or the story.
My bete noire was always Jurassic Park. There's a mathematician there who's sort of a troublemaker, and he's convinced this whole project won't work because of chaos theory. And my response is, you're in effect trying to prove that you can't do it. Zoo. Well, zoos have been done for years and years, and they seem to work.
The troublemaking Dr. Malcolm makes the mayhem at Jurassic Park believable by rapidly mumbling something that sounds very mathematical. We'll accept the pretext because we know just enough math to get us in trouble, like an American in Paris nodding and smiling after our phrasebook French runs out.
This is a field where, great intellect is required, and the general public really can't understand it, even with careful explanations.
Unintelligible math makes for a great plot device, but not great plots. Modern math is highly specialized, and even mathematicians might not understand the dialect of other disciplines. So the math in math movies is relegated to the role of scenery, scribbled on chalkboards or, as in A Beautiful Mind, on windows. It's only when math comes off the chalkboard that things really get interesting.
1245. Restate my assumptions. 1. Mathematics is the language of nature. 2. Everything around us can be represented and understood through numbers. 3. If you graph the numbers of any system, patterns emerge. Therefore, there are patterns everywhere in nature.
Rather than focusing on specifics, Darren Aronofsky's 1998 film Pi hints at the universality of math. We get an idea of math's philosophical, not scientific, nature. But it's a scene in Ong Lee's 1993 suburban drama The Ice Storm that really captures the simple beauty and mind-expanding nature of mathematics.
It's like, when they say 2 squared, they think it means 2 times 2 equals 4. But really, they really mean a square. It's really space. It's not numbers, it's space. And it's perfect space. But only in your head. Because you can't draw a perfect square in the material world. But in your mind, you can have perfect space. You know?
Yeah. But I just need some help with my homework.
It appears that sense of wonder will play a role in a soon-to-be-released movie about the mathematicians who cracked the Nazis' unbreakable Enigma code.
Why are you a mathematician? Do you like sums?
I like numbers. Because with numbers, truth and beauty are the same thing. You know you're getting somewhere when the equations start looking beautiful. Then you know the numbers are taking you closer to the secret of how things are.
But whether or not Enigma gets the math right, I'm pretty sure that Arnold Reinhold and mathematicians everywhere are going to love it.
You're as glamorous as fighter pilots. Girls you couldn't even hope to meet go weak at the knees at the thought of the size of your brain. Isn't that right?
For Studio 360, I'm Matt Holzman.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 today with the actor and filmmaker Danica McKellar, and we're talking about math in the movies. Danica, do you think that the stereotypes of mathematicians in the movies or in theater and books, are they generally accurate?
Well, they're usually caricatures of mathematicians, but some of the stuff really is accurate. I mean, the idea of the absent-minded professor really happens. It happened to me. You know, being socially isolated certainly happens. Whether mathematicians could be socially involved or not, that's where it becomes unfair because they make it look like mathematicians don't know how to interact with people. That's not really what's going on. It's really more that there's this other world that's a little more interesting in some ways than day-to-day living. So it's a choice to be isolated there.
Well, it's interesting also, and obviously with Beautiful Mind having won the Academy Award, that depiction of John Forbes Nash, an actual mathematician, now will stand in everybody's mind as the mathematician, and he was schizophrenic. And I wonder if I think that one of the ways in which that movie works is to say that there is this blurry line almost inevitably between genius and madness. And I wonder how you responded to that.
Well, you know, I mean, but madness is subjective, right? So they always say maybe the crazy people are the only sane ones.
Yeah.
I mean, it's what genius is, I think, is isolating and it's separatist. So, yeah, certainly in A Beautiful Mind, you know, he sees people who aren't really there and he's deluding himself and into having interactions with imaginary people. But, you know, again, it's a character. It's a caricature. It's an exaggeration, but I think that most generalizations, including mathematicians, do come from something that is true.
Well, there was that nice moment in A Beautiful Mind where he and his buddies are trying to figure out how to pick up a girl, and he realizes the basis of what he won the Nobel Prize for later. Do those aha sort of eureka moments actually happen? To your knowledge in math?
You know, it's not as glamorous as you'd like to think it is. When I was doing the research paper, you know, you try to solve something and you think that it's true, but usually the way to solving the problem involves many, many, many steps and sub-steps. And at any point along the way, you could have made a logical error that's tiny that you don't notice for a while. And then you think you've solved it, and you think you've had your aha moment, but then you go through it and, oh, well, okay, that didn't really take this case into consideration. Okay, let's go back and we need a new way to solve it because this way didn't, you know, can't take that particular case into consideration. And so you solve it again and you try to work it out again, and that was just one sub-step. And then, you know, you come over here to this other sub-step and realize that there was a problem with that. And then you go, okay, well, gosh, is any of this true? And then you go back and find a new way to solve that section of the problem.
Well, on one hand, what you've just described sounds not unlike artistic creation of aha moments followed by lots of sense of failure and trying to get it right again. But what there is in mathematics, as you've also just described, there is an error-free truth, whereas in any kind of art, there's no such thing as the absolute truth that is objectively agreed upon. I guess that's the difference.
Right. Well, in a math, right, there's something, there is a right and a wrong in terms of did you prove it or didn't you? There are many, many ways of doing it. And your imagination is what helps you find those ways. But either it's proven or it isn't. Whether anyone actually could verify that is, you know, sometimes remains to be seen. But the fact is, either it's proven or it isn't. And it is clear in that sense.
And, well, there was that line in that forthcoming film about the Enigma Code guys, mm-hmm. where the guy says truth and beauty are the same thing, which is why he likes math. And I think that's probably why movie makers have been so attracted to mathematicians as characters, because it's sort of what we used to regard artists as our searchers for truth and beauty. And I think in a certain way we no longer buy that, whereas mathematicians really seem to be in some kind of absolute mystical sense, you know, on the hunt for truth and beauty.
Well, I don't know that mathematicians, you know, it's a different kind of personality and it's a different kind of pursuit, because, like he said, math is the one place where truth and beauty are the same thing. And I think that the pursuit of truth as an artist is often resulting in not something beautiful, something tragic. And, you know, and something you can find the beauty in the tragedy of it, but it's a lot different from the very childlike pursuit, really, of mathematicians, which is to find stuff that works and it's true and it's, look at how cool that was, and it's idealistic. It's like living on a different plane. You know, the one downside for me was, again, that it's a different plane for most people.
It's very interesting, actually. I'd never thought of it as a childlike pursuit, and you're exactly right. There is nothing ugly or tragic or very ambiguous about math, is there?
It's difficult, but in some ways simple, because you're just trying to solve the problems, and you can and the way you solve them is the big playground. And of course, there are frustrations. People will spend years trying to solve something that isn't actually solvable, and yeah, that's devastating. But what you were pursuing was clear, and what you were pursuing was simple and pure.
Danica McKellar, thank you for joining us today in Studio 360.
My pleasure.
Danica McKellar is an actor, director, and writer, and no slouch at math, obviously. Her last project is a short film that she also wrote and directed called Speechless. And her next film is Talking in Your Sleep. To find out more about Danica McKellar, or to hear any story that we did today or have ever done on this program, visit our website, studio360.org. To close our show today, a New York educator who's taking his math to the street. Every Wednesday at noon, George Noble sets up a table on 42nd Street near Times Square. On this table are a variety of math problems that he tries to persuade passersby to tackle, and a row of Snickers bars that he hands out to anybody who gets them right.
So what is the angle between the hour hand and the minute hand at 2:45 p.m.? Excellent candy. It's a good problem.
The state of things is very bad with math. The Chinese, the Russians, the Israelis, they stop in the street. Almost all of them can do these problems. Americans, very few of them can. So we're the 1,000-pound gorilla. But a 1,000-pound gorilla doesn't have to be an idiot. It can be a very smart 1,000-pound gorilla.
2:45
on the 9.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, if a circle is 360.
That's right.
So 15 is 30. 15 is 90.
Yes.
Right? And you got, so that's 5 minutes is 30 each. So if you go from 90, 120, 150.
It is for sure that people's understanding of math 30, 40, 50 years ago was better. And then suddenly they stopped using the old ways of teaching things, which were sometimes very good. You know, I find old books that taught fractions in a wonderful way, while the new books teach fractions in a totally unsuitable way, I feel. They started looking at situations. The theory was not explained, or the derivations. All that was explained is, what do you do if this happens? So they tended to make mechanics, math mechanics out of people, rather than people who understood math. And being a mechanic is not that difficult once you understand, but teaching understanding is hard.
So this angle, this is the hour hand, right? Yeah,
yes.
So it goes 360 degrees in 12 hours. So each hour is 30 degrees.
Right.
So this is 60.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
And this goes 3/4 of the way around.
Yes.
So this is 1/4, so it's 90.
Yes.
So you add the two, it's 150.
No, it isn't.
90 and 60 is not 150?
At 2:45, the hour hand does not point to the two.
It's two.
Yeah, well, you could, it could be a little bit off. What was your answer?
No.
Now, what was your answer?
172 and a half. Give me my candy bar.
Please.
All teaching should be performance. All teachers should be actors. Because after all, you have a captive audience, and abusing them is not where it's at. You have to keep their attention. I tell them stories. I tell them stories from the history of math, which is fascinating, which covers all the way back to, from, 1000 BC to now. You know, the history of the world is contained in the history of math. And I've always loved math. I don't see why anybody doesn't. I think the freaks are the ones who don't.
George Noble is a math teacher. He's also planning a math musical, which will debut this June. You can find out more on our website, studio360.org. Michael Rayfield produced that story. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC along with PRI, Public Radio International. The production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Carrie Hillman,
Peter Clowney,
Jocelyn Gonzalez,
Steve Nelson,
Michelle Siegel,
Lital Mulad,
Andy Lancet,
Elaine Heinzman,
Lou Olkowski,
Michael Rayfield.
The music is by David Van Tegum. I'm Kurt Anderson, and I do hope you'll join us next week here in Studio 360.
Studio 360 is co-produced by WNYC Radio and Public Radio International and is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Tiffany & Company Foundation, and the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, Glenn Gould edits himself to perfection.
The life of a glamorous concert artist
is hideous. For me, it's a great liability to have a live audience. I resent the one-timeness, the non-take-two-ness of that particular experience, you know?
I'm Kurt Anderson, choosing what stays and what goes. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.